Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, listeners, and welcome back to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. I'm Matthew Dalitz from the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Matt. Here we are again. What a wonderful thing. I'm enjoying the weather. Even though we're heading off towards winter down here in the southern hemisphere, my good friends are all heading off into summer up in the northern hemisphere. So, yay for the change!
Yes, it's exciting. I love the winter because I live in Queensland, so winter here is like a nice mild European summer. So I love it.
That's right. Perfect one day boiling you.
Now, Richard, you've been over to the United States recently, and you've got some tales to tell. So, do tell.
Well, I think there's one particular piece of information and sort of idea that I want to share because it's in my book. It's in with Dan Siegel's book. We've both been talking about it for years, and a lot of people. It's actually coming out of a longer history back through. Not just psychotherapy, but mathematics. So I want to talk about that. But just to say what it was the Interpersonal Neurobiology Conference in Los Angeles, run by the Lifespan Institute with Bonnie Goldstein and Marion Solomon now, who's retired from doing work. They've been doing this conference for 25 years, and it was the last of those particular formats of conference where, you know, a three-day sit down talk fest.
Right. It has been going for a long time. I didn't realize it had been going for that long. That's incredible.
25 years as a conference. It was the 20th anniversary of the publication of Dan's book, The Developing Mind.
Oh, yes. So, wonderful.
So that third edition coming out soon. So there was a lot of very interesting. Dan decided they allowed Dan to curate, which is great. I mean, of course he should. But it was a much more humanistic conference saying, okay, we've got all these theories, we've got all these mechanisms, we've got all these processes, and we've got all these clinical bits of carrying on. But what are we remembering and knowing about our humanity and about our where we are open, where we are closed? We did lots of fantastic exercises and activities. As you know, whenever I'm doing those activities, I always go, "Hey, I did that in acting school."
Yes,
but we just call it acting. We didn't call it, generative social structures and all these wonderful terms. But we also looked at, and there was a big exploration into some of the not sort of uniquely American issues, but they sort of looked at them, the unique nature of those issues, which is dealing with diversity and minorities and those majorities that are treated as minorities, like women. So that was really cool. You know, so how are we managing this process of moving from a particular dominant system and structure of society to a more open, more engaged, more responsive society? And because it is very interesting that we talk about minorities and say, well, they're just a minor part of the population. But when two human beings are standing together, they're both totally equal human beings. And just because one is a member of the majority form doesn't mean that the other one is a minority is any less in intellect, in interest, in curiosity, in ideas, and so on and so forth. So that was really interesting.
So a much broader context then, as opposed to more broad social context rather than...
Yeah, and as a lot of clinicians were saying, well, what's that got to do with clinical practice? And Dan would sort of say, well, we're trying to understand human beings a bit better. They were going, oh, yeah, but... That's another problem that we can talk about later on in another podcast, this thing of what we practice. But what Dan brought up to try that is just the perfect image and sense of what is right and what is wrong, or how to understand the way things are going in the sense of diversity, in the sense of social structures, in the sense of generative social structures, generative processes in therapy mm-hmm. is really something that comes directly from complex systems and yeah. equally from the theoretical framework of quantum. And it's these three fundamental stages of development of what we actually experience, what we call actuality.
Mm-hmm.
So top of the scale. Now, this particular model is occurring a gazillion times all at the same time because, you know, we don't wander through one actuality at a time unless you're a bit boring and not very good at multitasking. But we have actuality. So an actuality is like an action, a behavior, a thought, an idea, any of those sorts of things. This is looking from the human point of view.
The things that we're aware of?
The things that we actually do. The things that we actually do, even if we're not aware of them. You know, like I move my hand, up and scratch my cheek. That's an actuality.
Right.
Is the scratching of the cheek. Now, beneath that level is what we call the probability field. So out of all the things that have occurred in my life and through my experience, there's a series of tendencies and inclinations and likelihoods. Mm-hmm. So what I've done is I've developed, let's say the scratching of the cheek, let's do something as benign as that. I've developed over time a set of muscles that work in certain ways. I've developed a certain preferences. I've developed a certain attitude towards itchiness. Mm-hmm. And when that stimulation comes along, there's an extremely, it's not limited, but there's a less broad set of ways in which my hand is going to come up and scratch myself on the cheek. Okay.
Right.
So where did these probabilities come from? So how come I'm saying they become inclinations? How come I'm saying they become tendencies? So weren't they always, isn't that it? You've just got your tendencies. And of course, here's the really important key to the way in which we can manifest important change and radical change through therapy and through various other aspects that we mostly talk about as, I suppose we see as insight or the penny dropping. But below that, you have a possibility field.
Mm-hmm.
And in the possibility field, fundamentally, everything is possible. All the elements are there. So now I've gone back to the beginning of the story. So what happens in the possibility field is that there is a wave, an energetic wave, an experiential wave of activity or of process that occurs that then makes some things pop up and other things stay where they are and other things actually pop down. So in your they pop that, they lose frame, they lose relevance, they lose energy, others gain more energy and become more relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of the effect of, I suppose, our possibility field is what we bring to the thing, the nature. And then through the nurture, the experiential passage through time, a series of the field changes into probabilities, high probabilities, low probabilities, and very low probabilities as you go through the frame. And let's look at the therapeutic framework that someone who's got insecure attachment or someone has early traumas or someone who has some kind of other neurosis or someone who has a phobia,
mm-hmm.
that in the probability field, they have got a strong energetic framework. A few things happen, a couple of other stimulations occur to the probability field, and up pops an actual response, a single actuality. Now, what we do a lot in therapy is we work on the probability field. We have a problem, we have a tendency, we have an inclination, and we try and fix that inclination and tendency.
Mm-hmm.
We try and resolve it. And that makes a lot of sense and can be can be very effective. You change its frequency, you change its energy, you change its dominance, you shift it, and maybe that probability will drop down and another one will, in balance, pop up.
Okay, yep.
But the key to effective, immediate, and dramatically life-altering therapy is to actually drop down into the possibility field again, because then it's kind of like renovating a house. The probability field, you're renovating the house, and you can change the kitchen and the house is then pretty terrific. But what if you could drop down to the vacant block of land?
Right. Start again.
Send the flow and almost immediately pop up all the good things of the house into the probability field. Mm-hmm. But reconstruct, and maybe actually reconstruct an entirely new house, an entirely new frame, and sort of start again.
Isn't that what memory reconsolidation is all about?
And memory reconsolidation, absolutely, is the mechanism by which our brain, when we have a recalled experience, it actually, we make the labile, the connections loosen and become alterable. In effect, you are returning to the possibility field.
Right.
Because so established, our head likes it.
Because established implicit memory is providing those plateaus, right?
That's right.
Probability.
Yeah, that's right.
Probability and possibility, right? Probability.
Yeah.
And so when we deconstruct that probability, we come back down to the base level of possibility. Then,
We bypass it.
Oh?
Yeah. So what we do in a lot of therapeutic processes and a lot of things is we try and deconstruct the probabilities and pull down this. So we're doing the renovations. We know we're knocking out walls, sticking in extra doors, which is great. But you're still kind of in, there's still quite a lot of the same house there. You know, you're still in the same block of land.
Right.
So how do you drop down into that possibility field? Now, when Dan Siegel talks about it, it kind of brings the quantum, because this happens in quantum as well. You have the possibility field is the mathematical possibility of, it's a mathematical framework of, and there's essentially nothing other than possibility. And what you do is you have energetic flows over that, which is to do with things like photons and electromagnetic energies and gravity and the forces and so on and so forth. And they act on the possibility field, and in the short term, they will produce matter out of nothing, which of course drives a lot of people crazy. But it's not nothing; it's just that we don't understand what possibility, an empty field of possibility, is, because if we did, we wouldn't have the brains. We'd have different brains, and we probably wouldn't have half the problems we have. So you'll have, as we do in the hadron particle accelerator, energetic particles, the protons or neutrons or electrons, which are really just energy packets. These and photons, they strike each other. They stimulate the possibility field, and out will pop matter. Now, principally, it's very short, you know, a very short term, muons and gluons and some of these various elements. But if you have enough of it happening, when we do the particle accelerator, we're just trying to hit one against one, you know. But when you have enough of them happening, as you can imagine in the explosions in a star, the Big Bang, so on and so forth, then you will actually get these little muons and gluons and various other named things, they actually begin to coalesce, because they become the probabilities, they coalesce, and they then actually become matter. Yep. And this matter then coalesces, and we proceed on until we actually get to matter that is complex enough that it then settles into a different set of rule frameworks. It moves out of the quantum rule-based framework, and it moves into the macro rule-based framework. Mm-hmm. And possibly this is occurring around molecular level, or perhaps complex molecules.
Okay.
Do that, and they cease to have these. It changes, and we don't know why or how. We haven't figured that out yet. But regardless, it's of what. And do look at Dan's book, and he's got it in mind. He's got it in a few others before that, and he hints at it. My book with the Mirroring Hands, Ernie Rossi's, some before, and lots of other really fascinating people. And this idea that we can return down there by putting our brain into certain states. And based on what we were saying, remember last week, we talked about the right hemisphere.
Yeah.
The right hemisphere tends to have the sort of qualities that a possibility field would possess.
Mm.
Whereas the left hemisphere has these probabilities, specific details, likely, you know, more tendencies and likelihoods. And the more it confirms those, the more you get them as being the way in which, and as you were saying last week, creates a left hemisphere dominant framework.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, people have strokes, and like Jill Bolte Taylor, she says, "Oh, thank God for the stroke." As Ernie Rossi says, "Wow, I now appreciate music, which I never did before." The possibility was there for him to appreciate music the way he appreciates it now. But he'd shifted his probability field so that appreciation of music had dropped down to a lower framework and wasn't highly present in his awareness, in his actualities.
Okay, so we're talking about a shift in conscious awareness.
We're shifting the nature of where we allow our conscious awareness to emerge from. But when we're emerging conscious awareness from the probability field, then it's going to emerge in ways that are very related to our experiential changes. When you drop into the possibility field, then you have the opportunity. And this is what the brain does with the neurons when it makes them labile and says, you can actually do this differently. Now, what we suggest in Mirroring Hands, which we've talked about, is that when you move into that state of focused attention that is oriented towards possibility through curiosity as its orientation, we're suggesting that that is moving into or towards possibility area. Dan was saying the same stuff in relation to mindfulness, and we see it in meditation. We see it with radical insight changes. But what you were saying quite rightly when you brought up memory consolidation is that our neurobiology, and we just don't understand, we just haven't researched all the rest of it, but our neurobiology gives us some insight that it seeks to return us to possibility rather than just probability.
Okay. And I can see how this plays beautifully into another pet subject of yours, curiosity.
Oh, yes.
That stance of curiosity.
Yeah. Mm. So there was a wonderful thing that sort of happened serendipitously on a walk. So I'm in San Francisco because we did a Mirroring Hands workshop as well. I did the IPNB, then we did a Mirroring Hands workshop. And my good friend Michael Hoyt, who some people might know from his brilliant dozen books or so in brief therapy and single session therapy, we're talking about things and stuff, and he said, I don't know how it came up, but he said, "So do you know where the word trivia comes from?" Probably because he was walking around the neighborhood and listening to me talk, because sometimes I said, "I'm just being imaginative." He says, "It's pretty trivial." But he said, "Actually, it's a great word. And the word is trivia."
Okay.
Tri as in tree, via as in roads. So it is the word that applies to the three travelers who meet, or the multiple groups of travelers that meet coming in from different directions, who then share not deep and meaningful stuff, but just general information. You know, do you know that down this pathway there's a pub 200 yards down that has great pies? And they go, "I didn't know that." So this wonderful bit of trivia. And curiosity, I think, yeah, this is a way of just sort of visualizing curiosity, that you're standing, looking down the expected pathway, looking down the pathway that you're predictable and is reasonable.
Mm.
But there's a couple of other pathways that are around you. There's that other, that what else. And this is what I think is a reasonable way of sort of just simplistically describing the curious frame of mind, the curiosity way of being, is where at all points, not only do you have what you expect, the probabilities, but you always have this sense that there are possibilities that if only you could just explore them, you may possibly come up with something totally different.
That's wonderful. And it sounds very freeing too.
Well, it is, although sometimes my wife says, "For God's sake, can we actually just go to where we said we were going to go? Do you have to go? What do you mean we have to go on? We now have to fly to Venezuela?" You know, so, yeah.
It just thinking out loud here too, you and I, we've talked about doing these roundtable conversations with other professionals in the same sort of spirit of travelers coming together. And I wouldn't have thought it as trivia, but with your definition that you've just told us, it kind of is. And I wonder what sort of things can unfold
Yes.
out of those roundtables.
Yeah, this trivia word has been sort of, over time, it's been minimized into that the information is not useful. Mm. But if we, like, for example, if we wanted to have a fun game with therapists, we'd say we're going to ask all these. We're going to have a trivia. We're going to have a trivia thing all about therapeutic processes and so on and so forth. Well, actually, the information that everybody would be answering is pretty damn important, you know, and pretty darn valuable. But we've just coined this word, and it flows. And when it's gone into the general public, it's, do you remember, you know, these songs and, you know, silly bits from movies and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But putting it in the context that we've just done in this conversation, trivia is just accessing information that is within somebody else's framework, which of course is usually their brain, but it also might be out of their inspiration. It might be held in the body and then come through language, or it might just be even expressed physically and experientially. That by accessing that, that what you do is create a wider framework of appreciation of the possibilities around you. So having a one-on-one conversation, we're doing well now, but to have four or five people around there saying, yes, that's great, but what about this? Mm. Oh, and you know there's that, and you know there's other things, and suddenly you're sitting there. Now, some people say this is confusing and mingling the disciplines, so on and so forth, and that's a bad thing. But you and I are going, whoa, no, that's cool. So I'm doing this and this, and that, and that's happening, and they're all happening at the same time. But these four or five people, I needed these four or five people in order to bring out that whole picture. You know, the six blind men and the elephant.
Yeah,
our round table is saying, let's not make them blind. Let's take the dark glasses off and let's make us all see the whole elephant as best we can.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to actually doing those roundtables. Well, thanks, Richard, for bringing some of that back for us from your trip. Anything else that you wanted to mention about your trip to the US?
Love my friend Michael and Jennifer. Many thanks to all the lovely people at HelpApp, all my good friends at Gaines. It was great to see them again. You know, some of the lovely speakers who gave us such fabulous information. And the excitement of having 20 people in a room in San Francisco, doing mirroring hands and watching our beautiful, the person who volunteered, our member who volunteered, two short little 15, 20-minute sessions, realizing that everything that she'd been worrying about for the last 3 to 4 months to do with her procrastination, she had the dog by the tail.
Right.
And just by dropping down into her possibility field, she'd created procrastination as the most likely candidate for her problem. And she dropped down into the possibility field with the mirroring hands experience. I did one of them, Ernie did the other one.
Yeah.
And she suddenly just said, oh my God, it's not procrastination, it's decision making. And I actually have these two elements, and she differentiated them. I have this one that worries me and this one. I just have to choose which outcome is acceptable or desirable or preferable, and then I can get on with what I want to do. And she'd been struggling with this thing for 3 to 6 months. Amazing, amazing.
Wonderful. Stuff. Sound like you had a good time. I'd encourage anyone, if you haven't seen Richard in one of his workshops, he's extremely dynamic and full of energy, and you'd have a great time. So make sure you get along to see Richard. And where are you going to be next? Where are you?
Well, you've got to travel a bit. I mean, with Trivia, indeed. In June. So, June. I'm traveling to Europe. I'll be speaking at the Ericsson conference in Bremen. So we'll be talking about, and the conference is Therapy Without Words.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Even people who are German speaking can come into my things. Then we go to London. Then we're repeating conferences, workshops there. Then Portugal. I'm in two places in Portugal, Lisbon and Porto. Then a quick visit to my sister in Italy and off to Bulgaria. So okay. We'll do Bulgaria. Then we come home. Meanwhile, in between, I've got in May, I'm doing a presentation to the AHA, the Australian Hypnosis Association, in Sydney, and one in Brisbane. Mm-hmm. And then later on in the year, we've got various conferences here, and then back to America at the end of the year, Brazil and Phoenix. So,
okay, wonderful. We'll put a schedule in the show notes so if people are interested. It sounds like, especially the Europeans, maybe if they want to catch you, there's an opportunity there.
In the short term, London at the end of June and Portugal and Bulgaria in the first two weekends of July.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Richard. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we look forward to meeting you again next week. Thanks, Richard.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.